Самым народным министром россияне традиционно назвали главу МЧС Сергея Шойгу.
За что завидовать Шойгу?
Министр МЧС России Сергей Шойгу и губернатор.
Главы МЧС Сергея Шойгу, группировка российских
МЧС. Об этом сообщил глава ведомства Сергей Шойгу. В пятницу министр...
For more than a decade, he was Russia's action man, appearing at nearly every disaster, either natural or man-made. From fires and floods to explosions and earthquakes, Sergei Shoigu cut a calm, confident, and reassuring figure in his long tenure as Russia's emergency situations minister. He's also been one of the country's most popular officials, and his appointment as governor of the Moscow region last May was widely interpreted as preparation for bigger things in the future. Shoigu has been touted as a potential prime minister, and the Moscow rumor mill has even speculated that he might be being groomed to eventually succeed Vladimir Putin as president. Whether or not that is the case, Shoigu's next emergency mission is going to be a daunting one. In November, Putin tapped him to take command of the country's scandal-plagued defense ministry after the controversial Anatoly Serdyukov was sacked. He inherits a ministry rife with corruption and an increasingly outdated military that is in bad need of reform but deeply resistant to change. What happens when one of Russia's most popular and enigmatic figures meets one of its most entrenched bureaucracies? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Kirill Kobudin is still celebrating New Year's and will be back next week. But on the Skype line from New York City, we're very fortunate and very grateful to be joined by NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia's security services and authors of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. I understand you're fresh off a flight from Toronto. I'm glad you could join us, and I hope you had a restful flight.
Well, we won't go into that, but thanks very much, and Happy New Year to you and all.
Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to everybody out there who has maybe missed us for the past 2 weeks. Mark, we'll get into the military reforms of the Shoigu appointment in a bit, but first, I wanted to talk a little bit about Shoigu himself. He's long been one of Russia's most popular figures. He's widely seen as a talented administrator. He's pretty much scandal-free, at least as far as we know. But for somebody who's been a public figure and a high-profile one at that for more than two decades, we know very little about the man beyond his official bio. We know he's from Tuva. We know he's an army general. We know he served as emergency minister through three presidents and 10 prime ministers. I actually counted last night. And we know he's highly regarded by Putin, but isn't really part of the Putin inner circle. But we know very little about his political views. We know very little about his political affiliations. Mark, what can you tell us about where Sergei Shoigu fits into Russia's political constellation? Because he's going to get increasingly important this year, I think.
Yeah, I think he's a fascinating figure. And in some ways, he's fascinating precisely because he doesn't fit into that constellation. I mean, let's have a think about it. As a person, yes, he's from Tuva, but more than that, I mean, he's a Buddhist samurai sword collector. You mentioned that he's a general. Well, he's not really a general. That was essentially an honorific title. He's a civil engineer by training. He's been an outsider as well as an insider. He's an outsider in the sense of precisely he's not involved in many of the cliques and cabals that until now have been dominating the deep state of Russian politics. But he's an insider in that, unusually, he has a pedigree that predates Putin. You know, this is not a new man, though I'd hesitate to call him an old man. If you go back to 1999, when fresh-faced new Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin was being asked which party he would be likely to vote for in the elections, he said the Unity Party, which is the party that Shoigu had set up, and which in many ways was the precursor of the current United Russia bloc. So in some ways, I mean, this is a man who already has an extraordinary political base and has done so precisely without really being political. And the reason he's done that is for two reasons, I would suggest. One is he is very good at what he does. I mean, if we look for a moment at precisely what he did at the emergency ministry, he took this phenomenally dysfunctional collection of firefighting, paramedic, disaster response, and so forth services, which were at absolute rock bottom because largely of financial pressures during the last days of the Soviet Union and then the early days of Brezhnevism. And he managed to make them work. There are still all kinds of problems within them, but essentially speaking, the Emergency Situations Ministry is a pretty effective structure, considering its budgets and considering the phenomenal task it has in this huge country. So on a technocratic basis, he definitely ticks the box. But secondly, he's managed to be outside of the backbiting factional politics. But on the other hand, he's been enough of an insider that he's always been the person, he's been the politically reliable individual. You know, precisely, he was able to set up this unity party, and people were, obviously not just himself, but you know, people were happy to see him because they didn't think he had an axe to grind. They didn't think he had a secret political agenda. He's managed to do all of these, not so much without, I mean, he's made friends, but perhaps most importantly of all, and hardest of all in Moscow's rarefied political atmosphere, without making enemies. And that's quite an extraordinary talent to have, frankly, in Russian politics.
With the Unity Party, he was handpicked to be the head of that, but that was a Berezovsky project pretty much at the time. It was the late Yeltsin period, or just as Putin was coming into power, and Shoigu was clearly a good face for that party. And at the time, that was when he really emerged on the scene. That was in the wake of the 1999 apartment bombings, when his face was on the television and his name kind of became a household word at that time. And he became, I remember, kind of a dark humor of people saying Russia's become kind of like a bad joke. The most popular politician in the country is the emergency ministry. What does that tell you about the country? But it was at that time when his star began to rise. Now, you correctly point out that he's been kind of out of the clan struggles, but yet managed to be a central part of the elite. The defense ministry is right in the thick of that now. I mean, it's easy to be outside the clan struggles when you're running the emergency situations ministry. But can he stay out of the clan struggles as defense minister? When you're right in the middle, and you're talking things like defense procurement, defense reform, things where a lot of people have a lot of dogs in those fights. Do you think he can stay above the fray in this post?
Well, I'll tell you what, let me just sort of abuse the mic and actually just go back very briefly to pick up on that point you made about Berezovsky before touching on the defense ministry. I mean, yes, the Unity Party was a Berezovsky project, but precisely Shoigu's value to that was that he bridged the gap between Berezovsky's own people mm-hmm. and the wider Russian elite. So I think that's a key point.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
But the point is, again, going back to this business of the defense ministry, no, I don't think he can. I think on one level, he has a skill set that's going to be very useful, particularly in terms of maybe dealing with a lot of the phenomenally vicious internal conflicts within the ministry, within the military as a whole, which festered under Serdyukov. And likewise, I'm sure he's going to prove to be, and he's already sort of making quite an effort, to be a great figurehead for the ministry. It's striking that he could make apartment bombings seem like a good political platform rather than just actually have it and be an albatross around his neck, if I can mix my metaphors in a rather ugly way. let's move on to talking about the challenges within the defense ministry. Most of the challenges within the defense ministry now, beyond that kind of personnel management thing, are external. They're not about how you actually manage things within the military. They're about how you manage the military's relationship with the finance ministry, the political leadership, and worst of all, the defense industrial complex. And here, it's going to be the one area that we actually haven't seen Shoigu have to demonstrate his skills. The emergencies ministry, yes, he was good at making sure that the budgets were there, but we're talking about very, very different levels of budgeting. And we're talking about budgets that in some ways were locked ones. You know, each city needs a fire department. That's not actually in debate. Yes, you'd like to make sure that you have the money for newer fire engines, but broadly speaking, the whole question is just a bit of fine-tuning to the budget. With the defense ministry, there are much, much wider doctrinal existential questions. No one asks, what is the doctrine of a fire department? You know what it's there. So put fires out. Whereas with the military, there is a massive debate about what kind of military you need, what it's going to be used for, and so forth. So first of all, this is very much an unknown territory. We'll see what Shoigu's skills are. Secondly, the political environment is different. I mean, yes, he is stepping into a situation in which he's having to fight a lot of battles which are not of his choosing. that he's inherited from his predecessor. And yes, they very much relate to budgets and procurement. And here he's going to be dealing with a very different type of beast than the one he's had to deal with in the past. These essentially self-interested industrial cabals. And I'm not sure if he's going to be able to cope with that well, particularly because, this is the third and final point I'd make, in this context, his job is complicated precisely by the fact that people are thinking of him as a prime minister or a president in waiting. Because in many cases, there's going to be a tension. There's going to be what's good from the point of view of the defense ministry, and then there's what's good from the point of view of Shoigu's higher political career. And we don't yet know if he himself is thinking, oh, actually the prime ministerial gig will be a good one, or indeed the presidential one. If that is what he's thinking, then odds are he's going to sacrifice the defense ministry's job for making wider political friendships.
There's another complicating factor. And that is the way he was chosen. Remember, he was not expected. When Surdyakov's firing wasn't entirely expected. When it happened, Shoigu was not somebody who was on everybody's mind as the obvious defense minister. Remember that Surdyakov was pushed out by the Petersburg clan of Siloviki, Sergei Ivanov and company, right? Shoigu wasn't their man. They wanted to put their own man in there. I'm not clear who that was. Maybe you could shed some light on that. But it wasn't Shoigu. Putin picked Shoigu because this is how Putin operates. He doesn't want any one clan to get everything it wants. And he put Shoigu in there, if I can believe the interpretations of this I've been reading in the Russian press. This was why Shoigu was put in there. Does he run the risk of, Sergei Ivanov and company having it out for him?
I'm sure to an extent he already has them. And it's already interesting that the relationship with Rogozin, who was another one of the figures.
Yes.
I mean, he currently represents the defense industry sector, but because he's interested in military matters, I mean, he clearly either fancied the job of defense minister, even though technically that would actually be a step down in terms of precedence within the cabinet for him, or at least would have liked to have had control over the defense ministry. So yes, Shoigu already has made enemies. In fairness to him, in the past, at least, he has shown abilities to be able to smooth over such splits. But again, he's tended to do that by doing his job well. Mm. And unfortunately, doing his job well in this situation means picking more fights, because there are exactly issues to do with procurement and budgets, as well as overall defense doctrine, which means that actually supporting the interests of the defense ministry will mean going against the defense complex, which means annoying Rogozin, and also doctrinal shifts, which will annoy Ivanov and co. So exactly, I mean, there is no smooth way forward for him. But I think also the picking of him, I think, in parts also reflects the fact that there was no clear alternative candidate. Ivanov and Rogozin are both too senior. They wouldn't have accepted probably any such demotion, and it would have looked like a demotion too. They didn't have a clear candidate, I would suggest, who could in any way sort of mobilize some kind of consensus. And that's not stopped Putin in the past putting in figures who may not have looked particularly senior, able, or popular. But the defense ministry is too important to Putin and to Russia as a whole. I think it's one of the interesting points that, in fact, they had to go to someone like Shoigu. And I don't want to make him sound as if he was the last choice, but nonetheless, he certainly wasn't the obvious choice. He certainly wasn't anyone's political favorite, simply because they lacked suitable human material. There are limits within the elite as to how many good candidates they would have around.
Mm. Now, there's another thing he has going in his favor, and that is Putin is clearly very fond of him. It's a little bit reminiscent of the Alexei Kudrin situation, where Kudrin didn't have a lot of friends in the broader elite because he ran a real he tried to run as tight a ship as you could on with the treasury, with the budget at the finance ministry. And every time somebody like Sechin tried to take him out, he had Putin there to defend him. Do you see a similar dynamic developing possibly in the future with Shoigu? I mean, a lot depends on what Putin wants him to do. That's the key.
There is certainly a lot of truth in the fact that having the man at the top liking you counts for a lot. And, I mean, obviously, in Kudrin's case, he already had made a lot of enemies, and that protected him for quite some time. I would suggest that Shoigu isn't a chum of Putin's the way Kudrin was and, by all accounts, is. In some ways, precisely, Shoigu feels like a different political generation, even though he's not particularly sort of different in age. He was around while Putin was rising. Putin respects him. Putin has a lot of time for him. But I don't think, for example, he socializes with him. So, I mean, I think we're talking about a slightly different kind of relationship. But also, I can't help but wonder, and this is just speculation, I can't help but wonder what the impact of open speculation about Shoigu as a future president will in due course have with to do with his relationship with Putin. Mm. It's one thing for Putin to see people sort of more or less speculating about whether or not in due course Putin will tap Shoigu to be prime minister, because that plays to Putin's ego. It emphasizes the fact that he is still the decider. When you actually have people speculating about a post-Putin president, that's, I think, a very dangerous thing to be identified as one of the potential candidates. Putin gives no signs at the moment to be thinking about succession. He's, as far as he's concerned, he's there, he's the man, he's in charge, and long may it continue. And if Shoigu seems to be doing a good job, if Shoigu, I mean, who always gets these soaringly high approval ratings whenever there are opinion polls of which ministers does the public like, if Putin begins to think that Shoigu's getting too popular, that's the kind of thing which actually might turn him against him.
Mm. Now, there's another, as long as we're speculating here, there's another kind of maybe counterpoint to that, though. Is it possible that they're keeping Shoigu in reserve in the case that it's clear that Putin does have to go, but they want to make sure that somebody, that the collective Putin wants to make sure that if the man himself has to go, that they can appear to be, you know, it's kind of soft regime change, put somebody in who would be maybe acceptable to the opposition, perhaps acceptable to the opposition, but yet would not threaten them too much. Now, this is where we're kind of into the second realm of speculation here, but what do you think that makes any sense?
Put it this way, if I was one of these dark cardinals, these manipulators of the deep state, and I was trying to think, well, yeah, you know, maybe our man Vladimir has been around long enough, but we need to think about what might follow him. Shoigu, in many ways, would seem to be a very good potential choice. He clearly has the skills to be a consensus broker. And one of the key attributes that you're looking for is precisely someone who can manage intra-elite conflicts while keeping the deep state working. Secondly, he precisely has a considerable public support base and a very long-lived one. Again, I think, you know, it's important to stress the value of having been around on the political scene for quite some time. He's an institution. Rather than just them having to try and pluck someone out of relative obscurity. You know, Yeltsin was able to do that with Putin, but far better to have someone who already has considerable esteem. And thirdly, again, mentioning this point about his potential relationship with the opposition, the wonderful thing about Shoigu in this respect is that his politics are very, very unclear and thus open to be being defined. You know, he's a loyal figure of the stability and Russian patriotism elite without ever having wandered into the realms of sort of xenophobia. One of the interesting things is actually his origins, ethnic and religious, haven't become an issue. Obviously, mm-hmm. they might well if he was actually being considered to be a president. But I'm sure he'd find ways around that. He's been able to coexist with the Russian Orthodox Church without any problem. But the key thing is precisely he has always legitimated himself as a technocrat. He's always legitimated himself not on the basis of what I believe, but what I can do. And I think that is the basis on which either he could appeal to many members within the opposition, or perhaps most importantly of all, he could undercut them. Mm. Because if he actually seems to be doing things, dealing with corruption, dealing with essentially issues to do with, you know, social welfare and infrastructure and so forth, then it doesn't matter if you have members of the chattering classes chattering against you. The point is they're never going to get that kind of mass mandate, because if the population are thinking, well, okay, no, we need to give this guy a try, then you can just let them march on Bolotnaya and ignore them. So in that respect, he could be a very potent weapon against, or to prevent the opposition from actually ever getting that mass support.
Mm. Well, you correctly pointed out that this guy's always, he's this rare Russian official who has succeeded by doing his job well. And this is what has always, this has always been his armor against all of this clan warfare. Now he's got to, and we touched on this a little bit, but I want to get a little deeper into it now. Now he's got to do his job well at the defense ministry, which is the graveyard of all political ambition. It's a minefield. Just briefly, for the uninitiated, if you could kind of go through the key points of debate around defense reform. I mean, what are we talking about here? What is the challenge facing the defense minister? What are the debates about what needs to be done at the defense ministry?
Well, the clear...
In the military as a whole, in the armed forces as a whole.
Well, the clear mandate that is being presented to the defense ministry is that Russia needs modern, usable, operational forces. The problems are, what does that mean, and how do you get them? So first of all, to start it at the highest level, it's doctrinal. Theoretically speaking, Russia does not believe it's going to get involved in any kind of a major mass land war in the foreseeable future. However, there are many within Russia, particularly within the ministry and the military apparatus as a whole, who cling to the old Soviet model. They say that one day we might be forced to fight the Chinese on the plains of Central Asia or something like that, and therefore we need a mass army, which means conscription. So there is already a debate going on within what kind of army Russia needs. In practice, though, what it really needs is a force that can be deployed into, for example, conflicts like Georgia quickly and effectively, and which can also protect the motherland, and finally, which can also be deployed in peacekeeping or other missions around the world. Now, to do that, you need to fix two key things: Russian soldiers and Russian equipment. Apart from that, it's easy. The issue of soldiers, so long as you've got national service, as long as you've got the draft, then you will continue to have large numbers of only semi-skilled soldiers who, in the course of their year, many of them will scarcely learn much than which is the dangerous end of a Kalashnikov and how do you whitewash the wall of a barracks. These are not soldiers who are particularly useful. You need the national service if you're going to have a massive reserve base, if you're ever going to fight China. But in practice, modern warfare is a job for specialist technicians as much as anything else. However, volunteer armies are very, very expensive. And therefore, you know, although Russia has perennially said, oh, any day now we will be shifting to an all-volunteer basis, the fact is they're nowhere near that point. They're nowhere near actually having service which is attractive enough financially, but also just in terms of quality of life for the number of contract soldiers they need. So for the moment, they're stuck with having conscripts. And for political reasons, they're stuck with having conscripts for just 1 year of service, which just isn't long enough to train them in much. So that's the first key problem, is just simply the nature of personnel. On the whole, they're not getting good enough soldiers and officers, and also they're not being able to keep them. If you're a good officer, then in many cases you're actually going to get a better job after you've done one term of duty in the private sector, or even actually, ironically enough, in the emergencies ministry. Second point is kit. Russian technology is not, on the whole, of the sort of leading-edge standard. They have some good stuff, and they are certainly moving on. But the problem has always been, and this is something that Serdyukov tried to address, and it was one of the reasons for his downfall. The problem has always been that Russia has felt that it has to do it all itself, that it has to produce all its weapons and so forth itself, in part precisely because the job of the ministry was always to feed the defense industries. Now, that's just not going to work. If you want leading-edge technology, you're going to have to get it from elsewhere, and that means being willing to award orders to other countries, but also have other countries willing to let you buy their first-line kit. And Russia's still quite confrontational relationship with the outside world, high levels of espionage, quite aggressive political language and so forth, for some strange reason means that many countries aren't willing to share their most modern equipment with them. Now, Serdyukov tried to essentially run his own foreign policy and develop more positive and fruitful relations with other countries, and in the process begin to buy foreign kit that he thought would meet Russia's needs, and that went down very, very badly with the defence industry sector and with the whole sort of nationalist wing. So the point is, this is also very, very political. This is about money more than anything else. Russia knows, if Russian defence strategists are honest, they say that Russia needs an army scarcely more than half its current size, but that on which you'd have to spend rather more money in the short term to dramatically modernise it. The point is, at the moment, Putin isn't willing to commit that kind of extravagant resource to it. Frankly, Russia couldn't afford it. And therefore, the defence minister is constantly in a situation in which he knows what he needs to do, but he can't do it. So really, his job is to do the best he can.
Now Serdyukov was pushing some of these things that you were talking about, not just with procurement, but in terms of decreasing the size of the officer corps, phasing out conscription, and he ran into a brick wall with that. Do you have any indication? Now, Shoigu's appointment was welcomed by the officer corps and welcomed by the rank and file. Now, is he going to go down the same path that Serdyukov did, but just do it more competently? And if so, is he going to run into the same brick wall that Serdyukov ran into? Will they still be welcoming him if he does what needs to be done?
Sure. I mean, the initial welcome of Shoigu was in part because, quite frankly, Abby Impaler could have been appointed defense minister and they'd have welcomed him given the pitch of dislike which Serdyukov had managed to develop. It has to be said that at present, I don't get the sense that Shoigu is going to be pushing for reform anywhere like as hard as Serdyukov did. Now, in part, that might well be just simply because Shoigu is still finding his feet in his new position. It's, after all, a very sort of complex technical brief as well. But if you just look at a few little indicators, the man he chose as his chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, is much more of a mainstream military officer. You've got to understand, chief of the general staff in a situation like the Russian system is very, very important. When you have a civilian defense minister, and Shoigu is a civilian defense minister, regardless of whether or not he has the right to wear a general's uniform, you know, he has not risen through the ranks. You need to have your chief military figure, chief of the general staff, is there to be, yes, he's your advisor, he's your person who tells you what the mood of the generals is, but he's also your leg breaker in chief. He is the man who goes and chews people out and makes sure that they're too afraid to actually challenge your authority. And Makarov, whom Serdyukov had chosen, was actually something of an outsider. And therefore, he was actually willing to do that, which is probably one of the reasons why he went as soon as Serdyukov did. Gerasimov, he's a tough and efficient soldier. He's a tank general by background, and tankists tend to, you know, like more tanks, which is exactly what Russia doesn't need. But there's no real evidence to suggest that he's in any way a maverick. And his first sort of statements have been very much aimed at essentially reassuring the generals that they once again have a voice. In some ways, instead of being the foreman for the defense minister, in some ways the chief of the general staff has become the shop steward for the military high command. So that's the first point. And the second thing is, we've already seen scaling back of some of Serdyukov's efforts to get a handle on military procurement. I mean, for example, we're going back to the issue of tanks. Serdyukov realized that Russia does not at the moment need more tanks, especially not more of the sort of tanks that the Russian Defense Ministry can provide. It needs light vehicles, it needs more efficient, cheap, usable ones. Tanks look very impressive when they rumble through Red Square, but unless you're actually fighting a tank war, they're not that useful. Well, lo and behold, the Russian Defense Ministry is buying more tanks. It's buying more things. It's looking to scale back its procurement of foreign kit. It's doing all the kinds of things that the defense industrial sector wanted to hear. So at the moment, Shoigu seems to be making friends, or at least avoiding making enemies, above actually doing a good job in the defense ministry.
So what will constitute success in this post, in your opinion, realistically?
Realistically, a glib answer is not being sacked. I think success would be, first of all, scaling down the scale of corruption, which is one of the reasons why Serdyukov was picked, ironically enough, the sense that he might be able to actually sort of get some handle on it in a way that previous defense ministry hadn't. You know, probably about a quarter of the entire procurement budget is wasted. And when I say wasted, that's on the whole a euphemism for swindled. Within the defense ministry sector, within the defense industries, you know, one way or the other, at a variety of different levels, it's constantly being drained and sapped. Now, given that the problem with the Russian defense sector is exactly that it lacks the money to do everything it wants, just simply getting some managing to get some handle on that will be a dramatic improvement. Mm-hmm. Second key issue is life for ordinary soldiers. They've improved it slightly, but still, military life is pretty miserable for most. It's not remunerated that well and so forth, which also means that good candidates do not become and stay soldiers. If you can just simply get a handle on that, that would also help. But these are just, I hesitate to say incremental, but these are just managing the current situation as best they can. I'm not at present convinced that Shoigu has the will, let alone whether he has the capacity, really to take that next dramatic step and actually sort of bring a thoroughgoing military modernization, which would mean a dramatic cut in the size of Russian forces, which of course would also mean sacking a lot of generals. So that would sort of the ideal would be major arms cuts, but the likely model of success would be just simply managing what he's got more efficiently.
And a lot's going to depend on what Putin actually wants him to do, and that itself is quite unclear at this point.
Well, I think that what Putin wants is fairly clear in the sense of, you know, he wants these modern, efficient, usable forces. It's interesting if one looks at the war in Georgia. Yes, the Russians won quickly, but actually the lesson that was learned in Moscow was that they needed reform because they should have won more effectively and more quickly and more convincingly. So, I mean, he wants the kind of forces that are entirely unassailable militarily within Eurasia, that all of his neighbours know that he could intervene quickly and effectively and surgically. The thing is, though, that, again, we mustn't forget the extent to which, for all his macho rhetoric, Putin is always a very cautious and conservative figure. What Putin's not necessarily willing to do is to put his own political capital behind that kind of reform. This is one reason why where Serdyukov fell. Up to a certain point, he had Putin's protection. But then as soon as Putin decided that he was just politically too expensive to hold on to, Serdyukov was out. Mm-hmm. I think from Putin's point of view, he knows what kind of military he wants, but I don't think he's willing to pay the political as well as the economic cost of getting it.
Mm. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd want to add about this very fascinating figure and this very interesting issue before we move on to the next segment?
I definitely think that I know we're going to be looking at sort of future trends after the break. And I think to me, Shoigu's future is going to be important, both because he's a potential candidate for the highest offices, but also because it'll tell us a lot about how the deep state works. Because Shoigu is an outsider who's now suddenly been moved into an insider position. And unlike Serdyukov, who was clearly a manager, he was clearly just a technocratic, you know, let's get in a bean counter and see if he can sort of make some changes of it. Shoigu is a national figure. And therefore, we'll see if that arouses tensions within the deep state, or conversely, if he's someone whom they can assimilate and bring into their clan structures.
All right. Well, yeah, he's certainly somebody to keep an eye on in the coming year. In a few moments, Mark and I'll shift gears and talk about something I wrote about recently on the blog. What trends should we be keeping an eye on in the year to come? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line with me from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galeotti, author of numerous books on Russia and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. I'd like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Я уверен, 2013 год.
I am confident that 2013 will be the year of victory. It will be the year of success, the year of the triumph of our noble ideals. Have no despair, no apathy. Victory will be ours. Happy New Year to you. We will prevail.
С Новым годом вас! Мы победим!
That was Left Front leader Sergei Udaltsov delivering a New Year's greeting to the Russian people in a video mimicking and mocking the Russian president's traditional New Year's greeting. Across Russia, people dragged themselves back to work this week after the long winter holiday season. The first opposition protests of the year are scheduled for Sunday, the Duma's back in session next week, and the political season is about to commence again after several weeks of uncharacteristic quiet. And as the year begins, some prominent opposition figures are predicting a season of revenge and reprisals from the authorities. Parnas leader Boris Nemtsov says, quote, "The immoral, cruel, and thievish authorities that have gone mad will try to put many of us behind bars," unquote. And Yabloko leader Sergei Mitrokhin predicts, quote, "a tightening of the screws and repression, selective but very painful in relation to the opposition," unquote. So we got Udaltsov predicting victory. We got Nemtsov and Mitrokhin predicting a vicious crackdown. Mark, is this all hyperbole? Are we about to see an even more intense crackdown on the opposition, more of the same, a relaxation of pressure, victory for Udaltsov? What do you think? What do we got coming?
Well, I mean, if we're going to thinking about a crackdown, I can only think that the opposition wish for there to be a crackdown, the authorities would have to feel under threat. They don't subscribe to the notion that crackdowns are worth doing in their own reasons and their own right, however much the investigations committee might disagree. I honestly think that the initiative now has to come from the opposition. At present, they're spinning their wheels. They currently have lost their focus, and the whole notion of creating this coordinating council that was precisely meant to move them to the next stage has apparently done precisely the opposite. At present, there is absolutely no reason for the authorities to crack down on them. The authorities have not gone mad. If anything, they're now having a little snooze because they can afford to after all the worries of the last year. Now, that doesn't seem to mean that everything is done and over. I think that the point is that there is still a substantial reservoir of tensions and disquiets within the elite over precisely sort of the future directions and the stability of the system. I think a lot of people had quite a shock last year, and that hasn't just gone away because they've had New Year's festivities and has washed it away in a sea of vodka. Within the sort of intelligentsia, middle-class people from whom the protest movement has sprung, those tensions haven't gone away. I just think people have really having to come to terms now with the fact that a few marches does not suddenly mean regime change. But also, most importantly of all, within the masses. There are all kinds of hot-button issues which are still there on a local as well as a national basis. I think although people are not sort of clamouring for immediate change in governance, there is a lot of desire for change on a variety of specific issues, particularly as relates to pricings, but also social welfare, that are increasingly going to become sort of topics for concern. So there is still this charge of potential sort of, shall we say, crisisness, if I can create a word, that is just simply waiting for suitable magnetic poles around which it can gather. So the situation is not settled, but the point is, at present, the opposition has failed to do anything about that, to bring these charges together. And therefore, I think the opposition is not likely to be regarded as a threat at the moment. But this can change very, very quickly. I mean, again, we can look at cases, and I'm always inclined to think of the Solidarity trade union movement in Poland as a fascinating example of where almost out of nowhere and nothing, actually massive regime-threatening forces can arise if there is that hidden charge of discontent. We're not quite there with Russia, but nonetheless, I think that's the kind of model that we could still see happening in the future.
I'll get to the macro trends in a minute, and I want to talk a little bit about energy and what that's going to mean in the energy market and what that's going to mean this year, and the social reforms that are still on the table that are I think the authorities are afraid to put those forward right now. But what are you looking for in the short term? I mean, as the year begins, what do you think we should keep an eye on right now in terms of like what? I mean, I saw, for example, that the Kremlin seems to be sort of kind of almost backing off a little bit on the adoption ban, which created, I think, an unexpected backlash in society. What kind of things are you looking for as the political season begins that might give us a signal of where things are going?
Well, okay, I imagine that we're going to see, first of all, the authorities basically trying to recreate normalcy. They're precisely going to try and just want to say, look, you know, we had a mad year, but that's over, and it's now back to business as usual. So, for example, I think we're going to see the corruption campaign continue to be damped down. There will be a steady little sort of sequence of press releases as people get arrested, but they're not going to be top-level figures. And above all, there's even less sign that there's actually going to be a systemic attempt to address the issues of corruption. So I think they're going to be just trying to do enough to try and reassure the country that they're aware it's a problem and don't worry, we're cracking down on it, but not enough to actually alarm the elite. In terms of something like adoption, again, I think we are going to see a scaling back. I mean, in any case, this adoption ban, for various technical reasons, couldn't really come into power for about a year. So I think, likewise, they're going to scale it back. I think they're going to hope that they can broker some kind of a deal, which means that they can just let this lapse. It didn't work. It didn't work as a way of punishing the West, and it hasn't really worked as a way of cohering Russians around sort of that we're tough. I mean, we shouldn't overstate it. I mean, a lot of Russians don't care about it or are perfectly okay with it, but certainly it's not no one could really describe it as a popular move. So again, I think what they're going to be aiming to do is, and it's hardly an exciting sort of banner headline, but soothe irritation points. They're precisely going to not be trying to do anything sort of major or dramatic, but just simply to try and deal with very, very specific neuralgic issues and hope that the whole thing continues to bank down and settle down. And that'll also allow some time for some reorganizations, I think, within the elite. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is the year that we see some substantial government reshuffles, reflecting as well as creating sort of clan differentials, because I think what had happened is in the last year, the tensions amongst various factions, clans, and individuals had also become much, much more serious and vicious. And again, I think there's going to be that sense of no, we need to keep everyone on board. And if that means sort of some groups have to make compromises and some groups maybe actually have to be sort of brought down to, you know, cut down to size, so be it. So that's not exactly a very exciting sort of prospectus for the year ahead, but that's exactly, I think, what the Kremlin wants. It wants a year without excitement.
Does Putin still have the capital within the elite, within the deep state, to kind of tamp down the clan warfare? I mean, his role as the broker has been severely damaged lately. Do you think he's even capable of ratcheting down the clan tensions?
I mean, I think that he still has considerable clout. I wouldn't go along with the sort of recent suggestion that he is the most influential leader in the world. But he definitely has some degree of residual clout. But more to the point, I think there is a sense, a rather sobering sense, within the deep state as a whole, that the situation has got last year slightly out of control. So it's not actually as it were, Putin is having to put his own personal political capital on the line to force other people to adopt it. I think there is a fairly broadly held consensus within the key movers and shapers that actually they need not to be rocking the boat at the moment. And any who do rock the boat, the general consensus within the deep state will be what brings them into line rather than Putin's personal authority. So yes, he is weaker, but as long as he's working with the grain of the deep state, he's still okay.
There were some pieces in the Russian press this week that were, again, predicting that I'm reluctant to use the word crackdown, but that people like Navalny and Udaltsov, the people who the Kremlin see as truly potential threats, will be dealt with swiftly and harshly this year. But at the same time, the Kremlin's going to kind of co-opt the reform agenda. Do you see any? Do you
give any credence to that?
Well, I think this is part of the process that we've seen in terms of co-opting the reform agenda. Because in part you do that by bringing in measures and, you know, for example, saying, oh, we're now fighting corruption or whatever. But also you weaken the agenda of the opposition by precisely making the concerns that they want to raise seem less important. So, I mean, I very much think that this is going to be the year in which the Kremlin tries to marginalize the opposition by just making them look as if they're just, you know, a bunch of chattering class misfits who are making a lot of fuss about nothing. Now, specifically, I would definitely put Udaltsov and Navalny into different categories. In some ways, to be honest, having Udaltsov in place is a plus for the Kremlin. In the long term, he might turn out to be the sort of leader who can actually galvanize working class opposition against the Kremlin, maybe as he'd like, who knows. But for the moment, in some ways, he's the perfect bogeyman figure. Having Udaltsov, and particularly sort of the more outspoken he is, then the more you say, look, the people were there against us, they're just, you know, neo-Stalin retreads and so forth, they're not serious. Navalny is different. Navalny is different precisely because he is in many ways an opposition from the democratic right rather than from the sort of extreme and undemocratic left. And he's been able to bridge a whole variety of worlds. He has West appeal. He has financial sector appeal and so forth. So I think he is problematic. And I wouldn't be surprised if dealing with him is seen as a useful way of putting out a message, saying that, look, on the whole, we're going to ignore you. However, if you do look as if you're becoming a bit too inconvenient, we're going to get rid of you and deal with you. And again, so long as the opposition doesn't seem too much of a threat, then the Kremlin might feel emboldened to do so. However, I would just throw in one caveat, that they do that at the risk of making a martyr. I think this is, I think this stresses the extent to which behind this at the moment apparently quite placid facade of Russian politics and society, there are all these pressures and tensions. And you never know if Navalny, the martyr figure, will suddenly be this sort of galvanizing force. It might be, it might not be, but that's the whole nature of the current unpredictability.
Right. Now, one of the macro trends I noted on the blog just before the new year was the energy issue and and the economy, and that this is going to, if given that we're expecting volatile oil prices, given the appearance on the market of liquefied natural gas, shale gas, which is cutting into Russia's gas monopoly, that the foundations of the economy, which are the foundations of the deep state, are threatened to a degree. Do you think this is a year that this could possibly come to a head?
I'm not an economist or an energy specialist, so sort of treat what I say with considerable caution, if not contempt. I don't think that we're going to see this come to a head this coming year. I don't think we're going to see anything so sudden and catastrophic or striking or whatever. But if we look at the sort of the longer term processes, I absolutely think this is a key thing. Putinism is essentially a product of hydrocarbons. That was the sort of central saving grace of his first terms as president. It meant that he had the money to throw at a whole variety of problems, everything from the military to society, and indeed also to be able to effectively bankroll the corruption and embezzlement that kept the elite happy. And in this respect, it was like the early Brezhnev years. And the more that comes under pressure, then the more that Putinism comes under pressure. But as I said, I mean, I think unless we see some extraordinary and unexpectedly sort of dramatic sudden falls in prices of Russian oil and gas, it's not as if it's going to suddenly break. But what I do think we're going to see this year are two pressures relating to energy that are important. One is that control of the energy sector seems to be once again going back onto the Kremlin's agenda. You know, we see, if anything, it's trying to reassert centralized control in the hand of national champions. Now, as soon as you create these honeypots, you also attract more bees. And it'd be interesting to see if Sechin can maintain his position as Mr. Energy, because I think that's an area that clearly, if other figures within the elite feel that the status quo is under question, then they may well be wanting to look to see if they can actually cut themselves a piece of that action. But secondly, looking ahead, Russians are not stupid. The Russian government is not stupid. It has some awareness of this, and it's therefore looking to diversify the economy. The problem is it doesn't really know how to do so within the current system. So I think that's going to be another one of the key technocratic but nonetheless important debates. How do you do so? Because if you really want to diversify the Russian economy, you need to transfer funds away from current usages and put them into everything from higher education, which they are spending some money on, to, you know, developing the Skolkovo showcase science theme park, but that's always the sort of one response. But just generally to dealing with the rest of the Russian economy. Russian manufacturing is in a terrible state. All the other sectors of the Russian economy are lagging. However, in the Russian system, transferring money means transferring political power.
Exactly.
And therefore, I think that this will be a key test of the Russian system's ability to renovate itself. And I think it's going to fail. But the point is, I don't think it's going to fail in the next 12 months. But I think that these 12 months will see increasingly sharp debates and disputes about what to do. And ultimately, I feel that the conservative forces within the system will prevail. And I think, therefore, we're going to see the Russian economy sliding yet further, slowly.
So we're entering a period of potential stagnation, is what I'm hearing in the macro sense.
I think that's much, much more likely. I think, again, the scares of the last year have, I think, left the Russian elite unwilling to take chances and thinking about short-term stability over long-term stability. And I think it's a very, very stupid policy, but it's a very, very traditional one.
Anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Well, I mean, let's not place this as doom and gloom. We also have to recognize that, you know, there are positive and creative forces that are taking place within Russia. There are aspects of Russia which do work. I mean, you know, on a ludicrously sort of micro scale, having spent 2 hours sat on a tarmac in Toronto, and of course I'm not bitter, but I've had far better experiences at Moscow's Sheremetyevo and Domodedovo airports than I have at almost any North American airport. I mean, there are aspects of Russia which are still dynamic. If one looks at certain sectors within the technology industries, if one looks at programming and cybernetics and so forth, there's clearly a lot of talent. The issue, I think, is going to be, and I think this is one of the interesting things which we're going to see over the next year, it goes back to this business of creative capacity, that there are many, I think, even within the opposition, who would be happy to work within the system. I don't think the opposition is full of people who are just die hard, let it all burn, and we'll build something out of the smoking ruins. The point is that almost we have a state which would like to co-opt. And we have many people who would, in many ways, like to be co-opted on the right terms and so forth. But at the moment, there is no real dialogue. Now, that's a dangerous thing, but it's also a potential. And if, whether it's the Shoigus of this world or the Kudrins or whoever else, emerge who are actually able to recreate that, I think just as at the moment the deep state is aware of its troubles, I think many within the opposition are currently going through a period of sober introspection. And I think if they were offered a relatively limited scope for feeling that they actually mattered and counted and they were being listened to, I think they'll be willing to be co-opted. It's a relatively narrow window of opportunity, but I think it is open at the moment. Sadly, and because we are talking about Russia, I have to end with the pessimistic element. I think that this window is going to be neglected by both sides, but it is there.
On that happy note, we'll wrap up. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galliotti, author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, Mark.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. Join us again next week when Kirill will be back in the saddle and hopefully fully recovered from his holiday festivities. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.